The North Carolina Reading Service is pleased to bring this program to our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. It's the Independent Indie Week, read this week by John Federson, and the issue is dated of April the 23rd of 2026. All right, let's get going with our articles. The first one, the feds fining a Durham-based energy efficiency company $722 million. FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has fined Durham-based American Efficiency this money and ordered the company to repay more than $410 million in, quote, unjust profits for alleged fraud in its energy efficiency program. In an April the 15th ruling, FERC, we'll call it FERC, claims that American Efficient withheld key information from electric grid operators that allowed the company to manipulate energy markets. A spokesman for American Efficient said the company, quote, stands by its position that the commission's allegations are meritless and that it did not commit any wrongdoing. FERC took issue with the company's business model. The Durham entrepreneur Ben Abram and his company, Wylan Capital, purchased American Efficient in 2013, and since then, it has been an energy efficiency aggregator that buys sales data and, quote, environmental attributes, the inherent characteristics of light bulbs, appliances, and other products that make them energy efficient. They buy sales data and these attributes from large retailers like Lowe's, as well as other companies. Then, American Efficient used that sales data to calculate the energy savings from the anticipated use of lighting and appliances, and they entered those projected savings into, quote, capacity auctions. At capacity auctions, grid operators pay for the ability of traditional power suppliers and utilities, like, as well as energy-efficient aggregators like American Efficient, to produce power when needed. Ratepayers ultimately pay for the cost of fuel through their respective utilities. The decision was unanimous among the five commissioners, 3 Democrat and 2 Republican. FERC Commissioner Lindsey C., a Biden appointee, at a public meeting said, I don't vote lightly for disgorgement and civil penalties this high, but we've not been faced with the scam that robbed ratepayers of hundreds of millions of dollars in this way before. American Efficient has fought with every legal tool they can muster, and it's easy to understand why, because their entire business is at stake. Their entire business is a scam. The other two Biden appointees, Judy Chang and David Rosen, criticized American Efficient for sullying legitimate energy efficiency programs that actually reduced demand. FERC Commissioner David Lacerte, a Trump appointee, said he will refer the case to the U.S. Department of Justice for a possible criminal investigation. He said at the public meeting that he is concerned about how American Efficient spent its proceeds from these capacity auctions, which the company says in a press release included solar projects in Brazil. Lacerte wrote in a concurring opinion, while I do not take lightly the weight of a criminal referral, the interests of justice demand it. American Efficient's conduct is not only market manipulation, but a fundamental betrayal of the environmental and reliability principles that have been used to justify energy efficiency resources in the first place. Now, I'll point out that this article, which you can find on IndieWeek.com in its entirety, is going to include a simple guide to the complex world of energy sales. I'm going to forego that portion. It's several paragraphs long. And if we time permits, I may come back to it. But you can find this article, as I'm saying, and all other articles, both current and in the past, on IndieWeek.com. They're free. So, the investigation into American Efficient began nearly 5 years ago after independent market monitors alerted FERC's enforcement staff. Grid operators like PJM, which operates in many states, including northeastern North Carolina, hire market monitors to ensure the wholesale energy markets are fair and to identify potential manipulation. American Efficient pays a few cents to these entities per product sold, micropayments ostensibly meant to encourage retailers to promote efficient products. In turn, use of more efficient products would reduce energy demand, air pollution, and greenhouse gas emission. American Efficient declined an on-the-record interview and instead provided statements by an unnamed company spokesperson. Quote, "What made this approach different is that the end user wasn't the only party that could move the needle on energy efficiency. The micropayments, quote, sent a powerful signal through the supply chain." FERC argued that a 5-cent payback on a single light bulb cannot influence retailer behavior. But the company spokesman said, "But 5 cents multiplied across every qualifying product sale in every qualifying store adds up, and the academic literature on upstream market transformation confirms what common sense suggests. When you offer incentives at scale, supply chains respond." Unquote. Over the past 12 years, federal records show that several grid operators, including PJM, have paid American Efficient a total of more than $500 million at these auctions. Grid operators use proceeds from ratepayers' energy bill, that's us folks, to pay power suppliers and energy efficiency companies for the ability to produce power when needed. The payments were based on the theory that encouraging energy efficiency reduces the amount of power grid operators must procure, lowers the cost of energy, and saves ratepayers on their monthly bills. "These reductions are validated," said the spokesman for the company, quote, "through well-established measurement and verification protocols used by utilities and energy companies across the country." FERC strongly disagreed. Commissioners gave the example of an agreement between American Efficient and Home Depot over an $11,000 refrigerator. If a customer bought that refrigerator from the store, Home Depot would note it on a sales data sheet that it sent to American Efficient. Federal documents show American Efficient would then send Home Depot a micropayment of 15 cents in return for the environmental attributes of its refrigerator. The company contends it obtained the right to bid energy savings associated with that refrigerator into the PJM capacity auction through this arrangement, and that PJM knew how it worked. FERC found the connection tenuous because American Efficient's contract with Home Depot did not require the retailer to use the micropayment for any specific purpose, such as discounting or promoting the sale of the refrigerator. American argues that its contract with PJM, in turn, did not require the company to prove that the program caused demand reductions that would not have occurred otherwise. Quote, "If there had been such a requirement, the company would obviously have designed the program and the measurement of its impact to comply with those requirements." "Selling environmental attributes is not new," said Ari Pesco, the director of the Electricity Law Initiative at Harvard Law School. Pesco was traveling and not available for an interview, but pointed to his comments about the case on Twitter for context. He wrote, "American Efficient conjured up these attributes, which is clever, fraudulent, or a little bit of both," he wrote. "Initially, the company seemed to be upfront with the grid operators about what it was doing," Pesco wrote, "then later claimed its payments to the retailers increased sales of efficient appliances." Quote, its plan seemed to unravel from there. However, PESCO questioned whether FERC's case is that straightforward. The contract between PJM and American doesn't require the company to prove a connection to the retail customer, as the commission maintains in its ruling. PESCO wrote, conduct that looks bad can still be legal. Finally, American Efficient still has legal options to fight the civil penalties. First, the U.S. Supreme Court is currently considering two cases that consider whether the procedures federal commissions use for assessing penalties comply with a constitutional right to a jury trial. In those cases, it's the Federal Communications Commission in question, though the ruling could affect FERC as well. Second, FERC must now file a separate action in federal district court and prove its case from scratch in order to collect the funds. A trial would also give the company an opportunity to present evidence before a judge and jury. As for the criminal referral, the U.S. Department of Justice can choose whether to investigate FERC's claims. American Efficient spokesperson, we are focused on defending the business. This was an American energy company built with private capital, advancing an all-of-the-above energy strategy that treated efficiency as a resource, just like any power plant. It has been brought to the brink of financial ruin by a single federal agency acting as its own prosecutor, judge, and jury. American Efficiency has few options to participate in capacity auctions. Of the grid operators in the eastern U.S., only one, ISO New England, still buys energy efficiency resources. Yet, ISO New England became concerned about one of American Efficiency's subsidiaries when it participated in the auctions in 2018 and partially disqualified the company from a subsequent auction, FERC documents show. The reason? The company could not provide enough information to prove its business model worked. As I said, now I'm going to refrain from the sidebar, A Simple Guide to the Complex World of Energy Sales. And if there's time at the close of this broadcast, enough time, I'll attempt to read it. It'll add another 7 or 8 minutes or more to the show. Next, we move over to Apex and their budget. Apex Town Manager Randy Vosburgh was matter-of-fact during his presentation of the proposed budget last week, although Town Council members may have to make some tough decisions as they face a roughly $6 million gap between revenues and expenses. Town officials cut about $14 million from the proposed budget before even presenting it to the council in order to avoid a larger funding gap, as Apex struggles to cover growing employee costs, in part because of inflation. Vosburgh advised they pull back on hiring new staff. The town manager also proposed dipping into the town's savings to cover some of the costs for fiscal 26-27, but that still leaves the town council short of funds to cover everything staff say is needed. With a pressing demand for new equipment and infrastructure, council members may consider raising property taxes and utility fees to cover the difference. The town's finance committee is set to meet April 23 and 30 to continue discussing the budget. After that, a town council workshop is scheduled for May 8th, followed by a public hearing tentatively for May 28th. But if the town council needs more time to discuss the budget, additional meetings may be scheduled. Takeaways. Like other towns, Apex is looking at a property tax increase. Those for Apex homeowners may go up this year as the town considers raising the rate from about 35 cents to 39 cents per $100 of value. So the average Apex resident with a $600,000 home would pay an additional $212 each year. The proposed increase would raise money for the town to pay for new police and firefighter positions, New police cars and fire trucks, new infrastructure and ongoing maintenance, and expanding programs at the Halle Performing Arts Center and Apex Community Centers, among other things. After a property reevaluation in 2024, which saw the value of many Apex homes spike, the town decreased its tax rate by nearly 23% to mitigate increases in tax bills. In the years since that, however, the town has slowly had to increase its rates, according to Vosburgh. The town's revenues were lower than expected this year, thanks in part to a drop in property tax collection and a recent slowdown of growth in property values, explained Jessica Hoffman, the town's budget director. Interest rates are also going down, which means the town earned less money than expected on its investments. 2. The average homeowner's utility bill may go up. In addition to the property increase, Apex may see its bills for electric, water, and sewer provided by the town all rise, along with the fee for yard waste collection. The cost will vary based on how much those utilities are used in each home, but the average resident could see an increase of about $16 per month, according to Vosburgh. The town is proposing a rate hike to cover a gap in its overall budget as revenues go down and expenses go up. That rate hike will help keep the lights on, the water running, and the sewer system working, according to Marty Stone, assistant town manager. The proposed fiscal 26-27 budget includes about $15 million total for the town's development and operations, including utilities. That money will pay for a long list of things, including $7 million to expand the town's electric system, including to the new Viridia development, future home of the NC Children's Hospital, $2.5 million to upgrade one electric substation and build a new one, $1.5 million to replace the town's UV system for water disinfection, and $175,000 to stabilize the Capitata crossing stream to reduce erosion and mitigate flooding. As town council members move forward on the budget, several said they will be considering the impact of these potential cost increases on vulnerable residents, particularly those on a fixed income. Councilmember Ed Gray mentioned speaking with one resident who didn't turn on her heat last winter because she was worried about money. Gray added, in the summertime, she doesn't turn on the air conditioning. She's that focused on making sure she can maintain a budget. That's the person in my mind that I'm trying to make sure we don't have an impact on. Like other towns, Apex is seeing an increase in expenses thanks to inflation, and as the cost of equipment and construction spikes, the price tags for the town's long-term projects are shooting up. For example, the Salem Streetscape project is now expected to cost 57% more than initial estimates, said Hoffman. Another project to convert streetlights to LED is now expected to cost more than double its initial estimate. These increasing costs could make it difficult for the town to keep planned projects on track. Last year, the Raleigh City Council scrapped its Six Forks Road project because of ballooning costs. In Apex, paying for the town staff's wages, retirement benefits, and health insurance is also getting more expensive, in part due to inflation. Hoffman said all these compensations, benefits increases, that's over $5 million. That takes up all the natural growth that we are seeing in our revenue before we go on to other funding sources. Throughout town hall, department heads asked for 57 additional staff members to address growing workloads, including new inspectors, technicians, engineers, parks staff, and police officers. But only about 18 of those 57 positions made the budget proposal. Town staff are making sacrifices across all departments, presenters repeated throughout the meeting. According to the town's website, it employs about 600 people full-time. Assistant Town Manager Demetria John said, "Our focus is balancing service expectations with responsible staffing levels. There are budget realities and trade-offs. This year's proposed budget also includes funding for a new outdoor stage near Apex Town Hall to host concert performances and support town events. The good news is that Wake County is paying for half of that approximately $700,000 project, contributing $348,000, leaving Apex with the remaining half. Plans are for the stage to seat about 1,700 people, with about 1,100 of those on a lawn. The town is also exploring partnerships to serve as a satellite venue for performing arts organizations, including the North Carolina Opera, according to Wake County. The town is finally getting a new fire truck, 5 years and $1 million later. Apex initially planned to replace this truck in 2021, and since then the town has spent $1 million in repairs to keep the truck running, according to Demetria John. This year, they plan to finally buy a new truck for $2.3 million before it gets any more expensive. Now, I recall reading an article somewhat similar to this last week or 2 weeks ago. This one, though, is about we set out to assess local government's climate progress. Here's what we learned. I believed my actual last report similar was how every community around our area responded to requests for information, and it varied widely. But this is climate progress. Sarah Willits wrote this. The year 2050, probably because it's a nice round number, is a landmark year for many local governments that have adopted climate action or sustainability plans in an effort to make their communities greener and fend off the most devastating effects of climate change. If governments follow through on those plans, the Triangle could, in just 24 years, be a beacon of climate progress, with dramatically reduced greenhouse gas emissions, reliable public transit connecting the region, flood and storm-resistant infrastructure, and a lush tree canopy grown over current urban heat islands. With this relative utopia in mind, we set out to try to get a sense of whether local governments were on track toward their goals. So we asked 11 local governments, Durham County, Orange County, Wake County, Durham, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Raleigh, Cary, Apex, Morrisville, and Holly Springs, for their most recent climate or sustainability plan and their latest progress report for that plan. The responses varied widely, with most cities able to produce their plans and slightly fewer providing some form of a status update. The city of Durham told us our request was very broad and would take a great deal of time to locate, though Durham County was able to provide sustainability plans and more recent status updates. Holly Springs sent us its sustainability action plan from 2023, but no corresponding progress report. Cary approved a detailed sustainability and climate strategy in 25 and tracks its progress on a public-facing dashboard. Raleigh, Wake County, Morrisville, Orange County, Chapel Hill, and Apex also have these climate action dashboards. Most Triangle municipalities have some kind of plan to lower greenhouse gas emissions, transition to clean energy, and become more resilient to climate change. Some of those plans only pertain to the local government, but Raleigh, Cary, Carrboro, Chapel Hill, and Orange County have community-wide goals. In Durham, there's a community-wide goal as well as a shared goal for the city, county, and public school system. These goals vary depending on the community and its approach. Experts we interviewed told us there aren't universal standards for what a local government in North Carolina should include in a sustainability plan. Without those standards, efforts can be largely dependent on the values and means of a local government. While some locals, like Durham, that's the first in the state to adopt a greenhouse gas reduction plan, have been planning around sustainability goals for 20 years. For many places, they're kind of a nascent effort, said Christopher Lawson, a program manager for community and economic development at Central Pines Regional Council, which is a resource and support hub for local governments. Lawson said, sustainability, environmentalism, the thought around that is changing. The way we view our government's role in these things is changing to be more recognition that there is a role for local governments. Across plans, though, most local governments have a specific goal for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, with many also staking out plans to achieve 100% renewable energy by 2050. Some localities have made impressive strides. As of 2025, Carrboro's emissions are down 20% compared to their 2010 baseline. Orange County reports a decline of more than 40% compared with 2005 levels. Chapel Hill has dropped its emissions by 32% compared to 2005, and Raleigh reduced its emissions by 11% between 2014 to 2022. Wake County is 20% of the way to meeting its goal of 100% clean energy, and Durham County, meanwhile, has reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 18% since 2009. Plans for future emission reductions tend to target vehicle trips and energy use in buildings, which make up the bulk of local government's emissions. Among the interesting ways they are chipping away at these impacts, Raleigh powers its bus fleet with renewable natural gas created from residents' wastewater. Morrisville has rooftop solar arrays on 5 of its buildings. Now, Tobin Freed, sustainability manager for Durham County, told the Indy that before the county started implementing its climate goals, it found ways to reduce energy consumption at a number of county-owned buildings. Freed said, if you put solar panels on a building where you haven't done the energy efficiency yet, you're sort of still wasting energy. You're just wasting solar energy. But much of what local governments are trying to accomplish via their sustainability plans and reducing community-wide emission reductions, increasing public transit ridership, improving water quality, is actually out of their control, dependent upon the actions of state government, private industries, or residents. Triangle towns with ambitious climate goals are heavily reliant on the Republican-controlled state legislature and private companies to invest in sustainability initiatives. Freed said, we will not meet our goals without Duke Energy coming along. We set our goals, both the greenhouse gas goal, but more specifically the renewable energy goal, under the assumption that Duke Energy is going to be following along. Carrboro's chief sustainability officer, Amy Armbruster, said Carrboro was, quote, disappointed by the legislature's decision last year to eliminate a requirement that utility companies reduce carbon pollution by 2030, especially as, quote, it made our own goals a lot harder to achieve. As we reported last year, Carrboro recently tried to sue Duke Energy, arguing the company misled the public by downplaying the impact of burning fossil fuels. In February, a judge dismissed that case. Some plans, like Carrie's, are town-wide, which means the government cannot achieve them unilaterally. People and business needs to get on board. Carrie is encouraging residents to consider adding solar panels to their homes, or purchasing an electric vehicle, or, if those options are out of reach, plant a tree, experiment with composting, or try riding the fare-free Go Carrie bus. Sarah Caliendo, Carrie's goal, said the energy manager, Sarah Caliendo, is near zero, not zero, because, quote, it's better to be realistic than to set unrealistic goals and fail. The town of Carrie operates 3 wastewater reclamation facilities, for instance, which consume a lot of power. and realistically won't be running on fully renewable energy anytime soon. Armbruster told Indy that Carbro has focused specifically on reaching out to low-income communities and communities of color, which, quote, are both most vulnerable to climate impacts, like high heat or flooding, but also have the least resources, about updating their homes to be more climate resilient and energy efficient. Armbruster pointed out that updates can help people save money on energy and repair costs. Chapel Hill professor Daniel Spurlock from the UNC, whose work focuses on planning, environmental, and policy implementation, thinks policymakers could focus more on accounting for and changing human behavior. She said, I would love to see us be able to build more of our policies, taking into account all that we know about human behavior and how we can shift that behavior. Because sometimes we hope that, well, if we build it, they'll come. But if we haven't really built it well enough that it can alter behavior. Spurlock said, for local sustainability plans to be successful, they also need to address affordable housing, which some triangle plans do to varying extents, but without housing set aside for people who earn well below the median income, quote, a huge chunk of people who are vital to what makes our cities great places to live get pushed out to more affordable areas where they have no choice but to rely on a car, increasing emissions. Spurlock says, people talk about sustainability and they'll talk about the environment, they'll talk about economics, but if you don't talk about equity, you're not talking about sustainability. It's the question that many community residents bring up. Affordable for whom? And so I think that's where I really want us to sit down in the triangle and think hard about who bears the burden, who gets the benefits for each of these initiatives that we're pushing forward. While sustainability plans typically focus on one jurisdiction, the issues they contend with, like water pollution and regional transit, cross boundaries. We did find examples of cross-jurisdiction collaboration in the reports we received. For example, the City of Durham, Durham County, and Durham Public Schools are collaborating on a solar farm to help power facilities with renewable energy and, in turn, reduce emissions. Fried said, that is only possible because we work together. None of us independently would have had enough demand that would make financial sense for a developer to build a solar farm on our behalf, but collectively we could. Developing sustainability goals, implementing plans, and monitoring progress are huge tasks that demand more resources and more collaboration across the entire triangle, said Spurlock. Local governments need to work together on shared goals, strategies to help communities with fewer means to accomplish them, and steps to take when goals are not met. The Central Pines Regional Council has helped spearhead efforts to bring local governments together for regional sustainability planning. Spurlock says, we have a very fragmented system, even as we require a really integrated coalition to meet those goals. There's an adage that the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, but the second best time is today. That held true in our research. While Triangle City and County governments are now undertaking a lot of initiatives to be greener, it's not always easy to see the progress. In some cases, that's because it's buried in dense reports or departmental presentations, but it could also be decades before the results of these efforts are apparent. Transit projects take years to plan, let alone build. Public works facilities can't be transitioned to renewable energy sources overnight. Trees planted today will not provide shade until perhaps 2050. Now, this is Climate Awareness Month, or some such observance, and that's there are three articles about that in a way, Earth Month, if you call it. But this one is, we move back to a criminal report, or at least a lawsuit, which alleges repeated sexual assault by Durham Rescue Mission's former volunteer coordinator. This was filed this month against Durham Rescue Mission and the nonprofit's former coordinator, Lenny Sutherland. And it alleges Sutherland committed repeated acts of sexual assault between April of 2023 and February of 2024. The civil suit filed by the Lanier Law Group on behalf of an anonymous plaintiff accuses Sutherland of unwanted groping, kissing, and fondling, quote, 4 to 5 days a week, sometimes multiple times a day, unquote. Sutherland also threatened to remove the plaintiff from the mission if he reported the assault. Lisa Lanier, president of the Lanier Law Group, said, quote, he felt really incapable of getting away from him because he was able to hold the housing and services in the position he had at the Durham Rescue Mission over our client's head, unquote. Lanier said her client surreptitiously filmed an assault by Sutherland and that Sutherland was ultimately fired around February of 2024 after the plaintiff showed the video to leadership at the mission. Then the suit alleges that mission leadership told the plaintiff that if he took video evidence to police, he could lose his spot at the mission. The suit alleges that the mission was negligent in monitoring the safety of its clients and acting on allegations of sexual misconduct, and that it continued to provide housing to Sutherland even after his termination. It seeks minimum damages of $25,000. Lanier told the Indy that while her client could still pursue criminal charges against Sutherland, a civil suit was the clearest route to holding the mission accountable. Her client was dependent on that nonprofit, which provides rehabilitation services and shelter at multiple locations in Durham for his housing and employment. The lawsuit states, quote, the plaintiff was discouraged from reporting these instances of abuse to the police and was told he may not be able to stay at the mission if he went to the police. He ultimately left the mission in November 25, 2.5 years after his 23 arrival, according to the suit. Well, the mission said in a statement to Indy on April 15th, quote, we are aware of a lawsuit filed by a former Durham Rescue Mission client that includes allegations of a serious nature involving a former staff member who originally came to us as a client. We take these allegations very seriously. When the alleged incident was first brought to our attention, we immediately addressed it in accordance with our policies, and that individual was terminated from our organization that same day. Because this matter is the subject of ongoing litigation, we cannot comment further at this time, it continued, without addressing a detailed set of questions about the suit. Well, now, the Durham Rescue Mission has a sprawling enterprise with over $60 million in assets spread across its shelters, thrift stores, properties, and investments, guided by the philosophy that there is always, quote, one more bed. The mission typically houses over 450 people, with this capacity rising to nearly 600 during extreme weather and power outages. A 2024 investigation by the Assembly found a number of allegations of labor abuse from former residents whom the mission refers to as guests. Incoming guests are required to give up outside employment in exchange for housing and full-time work in its facilities, compensated with a, quote, benevolence that starts at just $5 a week. When Indy reached Sutherland by phone on April 10th, he said he had not yet been served a summons and was unable to comment. Indy sent Sutherland a copy of the lawsuit and attempted to review it over the phone. Sutherland said, I cannot speak on anything until I get legal advice. Three people told Indy prior to their knowledge of the lawsuit that they had heard that Sutherland had been fired after another resident provided videotaped evidence of sexual misconduct. Former mission resident Will Caldwell said He had previously complained about inappropriate sexual comments by Sutherland to mission leadership, including the president, Rob Tart. Caldwell said he believes Sutherland had him kicked out of the mission due to his complaints, although the stated reason was that Caldwell had missed church due to work commitments. Absences, Caldwell says, had been previously approved. Caldwell said, I worked for the mission a little bit over 2 years, right? And they cannot tell me that they don't put work in front of anything else. In a screenshot, Caldwell provided to the Indy, another mission resident told Caldwell by text message that Sutherland threatened to remove him from the mission if he continued speaking with Caldwell. The message reads, quote, sorry for blocking you. Lenny was threatening to have me kicked out if I kept talking to you. The author of this message confirmed their identity and the threats to the Indy. He asked not to be named in this piece. After learning of Sutherland's termination and the alleged video, Caldwell said he texted Tart. He wrote in a screenshot reviewed by Indy, I tried telling y'all about him, but nobody there believed me until something had to happen. Are you happy? The phone number he identified as Tart's responded. Caldwell wrote, no more relieved that he can't keep doing his crap and getting away with it. Tart, he says, Tart responded later, when I saw the evidence, I acted. The rescue mission did not comment on any of these texts, and Sutherland did not respond to emailed questions about Caldwell's removal or the claim by the other resident, who said Sutherland threatened to remove him. According to his LinkedIn, Sutherland started as the mission's volunteer coordinator in 2019. Photos on Sutherland's Facebook page show him performing a variety of duties for the mission, including delivering sermons, traveling for fundraisers, celebrating birthdays, and working donation drives. He later went on to work at Urban Ministries of Durham, and he was working there when reached by phone on April 10. An Urban Ministries spokesperson wrote in a statement 5 days later, said, UMD is committed to maintaining a safe and trusted environment for the communities we serve. And he added that Sutherland is no longer an employee. They declined to answer further questions. The lawsuit claims multiple allegations of misconduct were raised about Sutherland in the year leading up to his termination from Durham Rescue, and encourages others with evidence to come forward. Lanier saying, we just want to uncover everything. We want to turn over every stone, and we want justice for the survivors. You don't end up at the Durham Rescue Mission because you were leading this powerful, successful life of independence in the outside world, said Lanier. Her client remained there, despite the abuse, because he did not have other options. Lanier saying he was trapped. The alternative was, you know, being on the streets again and potentially getting back into alcohol. Now, a few articles concerned, again, with Earth Month. This one, Louise Omoto Kessel and the Clapping Hands Farm. Clapping Hands Farm sits at the end of a long driveway past old chicken coops and a pond. The farm does not use public utilities. There is electricity powered by solar panels on site, but no running water, air conditioning, or refrigeration. It also operates as a camp, allowing visitors of all ages to explore nature and art with programmed events. The camp director, Louise Omoto Kessel, used to live on the farm where she fully embraced this off-grid lifestyle. When she first moved to the farm, she lived with her husband, Holmes, in the only finished building on the property, a tiny cabin. I guess this article is exciting. Although Kessel can't remember the exact dimensions, in her memories it's about 12 by 12 feet with a loft where the couple slept. Kessel said Holmes used to joke the cabin was 3 stories because it also had a root cellar. In the farm's early days, Kessel said she fetched water with a long cylindrical bucket she would drop in a well. Then the pair pumped well water with a hand pump, extracting the water for themselves and their two horses. Holmes had a commercial farmer's market garden at the time, Kessel said, and they would sometimes have to pump water for the plants, too. After a while, Kessel said, they started collecting rainwater in big tanks to use for irrigation. And she said, we liked the fact you sort of had to go outside to take care of basic things, like going to the bathroom. You had to encounter the weather and the season, and I just love that. You were clear about what was happening outside, because if it had been cloudy or rainy for days, you might run out of power. We had a tiny little system for light. If it was cold, you built a fire. Kessel was a full-time storyteller when she moved to the farm, and a year into living there, she took on a new venture and opened the Clapping Hands Farm Camp. Kessel said, part of my feeling when I moved out there was this would be an amazing place to have a camp. I wasn't wrong. That camp began in 2000, with Kessel inviting a few of her friends' kids out to the farm, and has since expanded to a year-round operation. Clapping Hands offers 7 summer camps, a spring break camp, and programming days throughout the year. It's the kind of place where shoes are optional and tree climbing is encouraged. Kessel said the farm is an inclusive community where she wants people to feel free to be themselves. Fostering creativity and allowing visitors to learn about nature are also important parts of the objectives, she said. Quote, I think the outdoor environment is very supportive of all the things we're trying to do. The camp has working artists, craftspeople, and naturalists running programs, which range from ukulele classes to writing and performing a musical. Camps and retreats are offered for children, families, and adults, giving them the chance to unplug. Although Kessel and her family have moved back on the grid to a house across the street from the farm, Kessel says she prefers her former lifestyle. Quote, I guess it's a combination. It's equal parts just wanting to have a lower impact on the planet and just enjoying the connection with the natural world. To make a change in everyday life, Kessel said people can limit trips in gas-powered cars and start composting. She still has some remnants of her life on the farm in her current house, with solar panels powering some of their energy usage. Kessel said Holmes, who drives an electric car and has tried to stop buying any plastic, takes more extreme measures to continue to live sustainably. When Holmes moved his mother to North Carolina from Austin, Texas, he rode his bike to Greensboro, hopped on a train to New Orleans, rode his bike to a hostel, got on another train to San Antonio, then rode his bike to Austin, all to mitigate emissions from that trip. Both Kessel and Holmes' commitment to living a sustainable life has fueled the farm's mission, encouraging the same from their visitors. It's off-the-grid lifestyle, an emphasis on nature allow visitors, Kessel said, to just sort of strip away things and simplify life. It's one of the many things that make the camp attractive. And she said, it seems to me that the more you delight in and experience just being outside, things happen. A snake will appear. A butterfly will land on you. Things happen. People are more connected, and then they learn things. The next short article, I think I'll have time for this whole one. 15 years ago, it was a vacant lot. Now, Raleigh City Farm helps feed the city. Elliot Harrell wrote this. Arugula! A woman shouts, browsing the available produce at Raleigh's City Farm's seasonal weekly farm stand, a big smile on her face. I chuckle with shared delight over her joy in the leafy green. Arugula isn't necessarily always a hot commodity, says Lisa Berry, the executive director for this nonprofit farm, but this was the first farm stand of the season, and as such, certain vegetables were growing quickly. She explained, we're just starting to ramp up our veg, and we harvested just 190 pounds of food today. But in the summer, I think the most we've harvested 1,500 pounds in a week. Now, Raleigh City Farm sits on a 1.3-acre corner lot near downtown Raleigh, a vibrant pocket of urban green sandwiched between Blunt Street on one side and a popular neighborhood shopping center which houses the likes of Yellow Dog Bakery and Standard Beer and Food on the other. Over the course of the next few months, the farm will produce everything from strawberries and mulberries to gorgeous wildflowers and vegetables like kale, arugula, eggplant, tomatoes, and peppers. Just over half this produce will be sold during the Wednesday Pay What You Can farm stands that run from April through October. The rest of the approximately 10,000 pounds of food grown each year will be distributed to community partners focused on food insecurity around Raleigh, like A Place at a Table, Feed the Pack, and Carolina Cares. Raleigh City Farm started with a vacant lot in 2011, and Barry said farm co-founders Laura Fieselman and Laurel Passera first started noodling on the idea in 2010 before pulling in three other friends, Josh Whiten, Aaron Bergstrom, and Jonathan Morgan, to help. By the following year, the team had secured the land the farm is on now and raised $25,000 from the community with various fundraisers and a Kickstarter campaign. It was enough to get growing. At this point in her story, Barry pauses to greet a farm stand regular by name. Over the course of our conversation, she greets every customer by name and seems genuinely excited to see them. It's clear she's the unofficial mayor of the farm as well as its executive director and someone who makes it her business to get to know everyone in the community. She continued, "Before 2020, our business model was about supporting farmers and incubating farmers, and different ones had a different piece of the property. One farmer, for instance, ran a community-supported agriculture, that's a CSA, subscription business. Another grew hydroponic lettuce, and another sold food to restaurants. The site began to fall apart," she said, "so farm leadership decided to make a pivotal change during the pandemic, hiring its first farm manager to take control over the produce and production schedule, and it then evolved into its current iteration, working to meet food insecurity needs around the city." Barry said, "Our programming began to evolve to this hybrid distribution of giving away food all year long and finding partners. Our mission became one to connect and nourish our community through regenerative agriculture. It really took root. And from 2020 to 26, we've grown quite exponentially." Raleigh City Farm maintains a small staff, but much of the work is handled by farmer interns and volunteers. The intern wall of fame on a shed commemorates the roughly 50 hopeful farmers who have been through the intensive semester-long teaching program. Throughout the course of the year, Real Berry estimates that nearly 3,000 volunteers will help with the farm's upkeep. One of the most popular volunteer programs on Wednesday, called Wine and Weeds, involves volunteers pulling weeds while socializing. It's often booked weeks in advance. She said caring for the site is a labor of love and connection. On April 25th, the farm will commemorate its 15th birthday. That's a combo celebration of Earth Day and birthday with a free community event. But there's also another reason to celebrate. In November last year, the farm announced that it is growing through a partnership with the city of Raleigh and putting down roots at Marsh Creek Park with a second farm. Grealberry adds, "It's our next iteration and extension. The current location's lease is up for renewal in 2029. While it's unclear what might happen to that site then, this expansion will allow the farm's mission to continue if the lease is not renewed." She said, "We're looking at the future and seeing how we put down roots before we are uprooted." If you need to touch grass, and honestly, don't we all, swinging by Raleigh City Farm, whether to shop at the farm stand, pick weeds, or just wander, is an accessible way to do so without even leaving the downtown Raleigh orbit. And if folks will forgive me for pushing my story along, I have a two-pager about Mark Maximoff from Bike Durham, which I will probably not be able to finish. When Mark Maximoff set out on his first bike ride as a commuter in Brooklyn in 1999, he was nervous about the traffic conditions. "I thought I was going to die," Maximoff said. "I was like, how can anyone do this? There are speeding cars right next to me." Maximoff, now a Durham resident and a board member of Bike Durham, that's a local transportation nonprofit and advocacy group, grew up in the sprawling suburbs of Tucson, Arizona, where everyone drove. When he started a new job in 99, a friend convinced him that biking 10 miles to Queens would be faster than the subway. A lifelong fitness freak, Maximoff saw an opportunity to not only cut down on his emissions and commute time, but also maintain his health. His first trip out, riding his Trek brand 7800 silver commuter, was filled with close calls, but he soon discovered a new world, one that any two wheels could take him to. I'm picking through this article. One of the main reasons I became a bicyclist is I do care about our carbon emissions. I feel like everyone has a responsibility to do whatever is within their power to help that. When he moved to Durham in 2006, even the South's lackluster public transportation didn't tempt him to buy a car. Instead, he built his new life here around biking. He commuted 15 minutes to and from his job at Duke University, taking quieter back streets for their pleasant tempo and lower likelihood of encountering 4-ton murder machines, although he also has no fear of traffic should he need a more direct route. He travels with a messenger bag across his chest made out of rubber from post-consumer bike tubes and a strap made from an augmented seatbelt, and it's filled with practical things: a front light, bungee cords, shopping bags, metal chopsticks, chargers, and his laptop. In cold weather, he rocks a weather-resistant REI jacket, and in hotter months, he embraces the sweat. And that will have to close Mark Maximoff's article from the Indie Week. Considerably shorter than it appears on the website, indieweek.com. But you can find it, if you wish, there on your internet, indieweek.com. So John Fetterson will now put this issue into the proverbial can for it to be broadcast first on Friday and then become a podcast, joining thousands and billions of podcasts that now held in the repository of the North Carolina Reading Service, who's brought you this program, and we thank you for listening to it. And for Indie Week, we'll be with you next week.